vein of thought.
Shall I start it now?
Sure.
I'm pretty sure that I was also the first one to give a closed circuit TV demonstration in Canada. And perhaps, I'm not sure, the first one who participated in a closed circuit color demonstration of an endodontic procedure. I remember it well because the of the nature of the occasion. I got to Will's Eye Hospital, from which the demonstration emanated, a courtesy of the Smith Klein and French Company of Philadelphia, and they were testing out the equipment, and there was a pretty girl sitting in a chair with a beautiful bright costume on. At any rate, my demonstration was that of periapical surgery, along with three other demonstrations. It was given to 800 dentists of who were members of the Philadelphia County Medical Philadelphia County Dental Society. Those who wrote in for the first 800 tickets. There were eight television receiving screens, and 100 people around each screen. And I'm quite sure that this was the first color demonstration on TV of dental procedures. I think I should talk a bit about a change in endodontic philosophy. Up until about the early 40s, perhaps, stress was placed upon technique. Technique in which medicaments played a major role. Technique in which principles of enlarging the canal were followed, but without perhaps much attention to the possibility of traumatizing periapical tissue. Along about the 40s, we began to think in terms of biologic treatment. We began to be more careful about placing markers on instruments so that we knew the length of the tooth, and by placing a marker on the instrument, we hoped that we would not go through the apical foramen, traumatize periapical tissue. Also, along about that time, we began to think, or perhaps it was a little later, we began to think in terms of less irritating medicaments. I would guess probably this was in the 50s rather than in the 40s.
Did OSP have an influence on this direction?
I'm not sure that any one particular person had an influence in this direction. I think it sort of came from several directions. I believe that perhaps the philosophy so far as general dentistry is concerned, was more along biological principles, a more biologic attitude, whether it was the root canal or the gingival tissue, etc. And of course, it naturally filtered through and into endodontic technique. I wish I could recall when Lars Strindberg's monograph came out. But this was an important monograph from Sweden, in which he evaluated perhaps 500 cases over a period of five and some, in some cases, longer than that, years, which cases he had treated. And two things, so far as I'm concerned, came out of considerable importance from this monograph. One was that those cases which were failures were often failures because of overfilling of the root canal, and that it was safer to fill to the apex or just short of the apex. And secondly, that the larger the area of rarefaction, the less likelihood of repair occurring, which perhaps confirmed what we already knew empirically, or shall I say, we knew empirically but not statistically, namely that if there was a large area of rarefaction, it would be better to do surgery, that is, correctment of the area, and in many cases, removing 1 or 2 millimeters of the dead apical or so-called necrotic cementum and dentine. It was an important publication, and I think it gained a great deal of currency in this country over a period of perhaps 5 years. It slowly filtered through to the general practitioner.
Let me ask you a question along those lines. Surgical procedures as a routine have decreased markedly since the early days of endodontics. I remember when I was in the BU program and we spent a day or two in Philadelphia, I saw a demonstration of you doing a surgical procedure, and after it was done, I believe you rotated the burr backwards over the apex. I didn't know whether that was to remove the necrotic cementum, quote unquote, or whether it was to remove that portion of the root down a little bit. But I was wondering if you'd comment a little bit on how surgical technique has changed from the time where they used to cut off the root at the surface of the lesion to the present.
Yes, it is true that when the oral surgeon at our school did the root resection, if the lesion on one side of the root was perhaps only about 3 millimeters from the apex, and the lesion on the other side of the root was 10 millimeters from the apex, the oral surgeon would cut the root, sometimes at a slant, down to the 10 millimeter. Well, it was unusual, of course, for it to be 10 millimeters. I must say this, however, Dr. Theodore Blum, T-H-E-O-D-O-R, Blum, B-L-U-M, in New York City, originally from Vienna, M.D. degree, and the University of Pennsylvania D.D.S. degree. He, however, had stated in the literature and showed cases where he had just removed 2 or 3 millimeters when there was an extensive lesion, and that it was these lesions healed with good repair.
Were they putting in retrograde fillings at that time, or just cutting off the tip of the root, believing that that was the source?
I can't tell you how far back retrograde fillings were done, but I can assure you they were done very, very far back. I'm not absolutely certain, but it runs through my mind that retrograde fillings were done in the 20s by some.
Did you want to continue? Did I interrupt you with the surgical?
Well, speaking of the surgical approach, it may interest you to know that a hemisection, which somehow seemed to make the pages of dental journals perhaps in the 50s or so, hemisection was done way back in the last century.
I believe G.V. Black had...
Yeah, that's right. In G.V. Black's book, you will find a diagram of such.
Let me digress way back. I had heard from other sources that when you got back from your education in Germany, one of the things that you brought back with you...
Silver cones.
Was the silver cones and
that's
the
right.
Oligodynamic
well,
effect.
No, the oligodynamic effect dates back to a Swedish chemist, as I recall. I think it was Svent, S-V-E-N-T, Arrhenius, A-R-H-E-N-N-I-U-S, I believe.
Stenographer's going to love you.
I'm sorry?
Stenographer's going to love you.
He first postulated that metals in very fine dilutions have an antimicrobial effect. For example, if you put sewer water in a copper kettle and leave it there overnight, although the sewer water contained a good many microorganisms, the next day you will find that the water is sterile. And he stated that it was due to the fact that some of the copper was dissolved, forming a copper salt which caused the death of the microorganisms. The oligodynamic effect was made use of in the Kerr sealer, in which they used a precipitated silver powder. The fallacy of that, however, which I mentioned in one of my papers, is that here the silver is bound, it's surrounded by a substance, namely balsam of Peru and rosin and zinc oxide, eugenol, so that it can no longer exert its oligodynamic action. Now, silver, which, if I recall correctly, was introduced by Trebitsch, T-R-E-B-I-T-S-C-H. I'm not absolutely certain, but it runs through my mind that it was he who introduced silver cones in Germany. And along about 1928, or a little before, and I brought back with me some silver cones, and I tried to get a company to manufacture them. And these silver cones, incidentally, were atrocious in size and diameter. And they had an eyelet at the end like a needle, so that the silver cone could be retrieved. They were short, probably not more than, 18 millimeters in length. At any rate, I finally got a company in New Jersey which manufactured dental golds to manufacture these silver points, as they were called. And they were in use for a while when my friend, long departed now, namely Elmer Jasper, got a company in St. Louis to manufacture silver points, which more closely approximated the sizes and diameters of the gutta-percha cones that were being put out at the time. In a sense, I've always regretted that I had something to do with the introduction of silver cones in this country, because I can assure you that I haven't used them for a long time. I feel the gutta-percha is far superior. I know I must hurt some teachers' feelings, because at some schools they still teach the use of silver cones either exclusively or almost exclusively.
Getting back to offshoots of the oligodynamic effect, the search for medicaments to sterilize the canal, there was, if I remember correctly, sort of an in conflict, if you could call it that, of you at Philadelphia looking for specific drugs, and Sumner, Ostrander, and Crowley looking for non-specific drugs for use in intercanal medications. Could you go into that a little bit?
Yes. I think what you really have in mind, perhaps, is the use of an antibiotic combination, which was designed to destroy the various varieties of microorganisms which we find in the root canal, namely gram-positive, gram-negative, and yeast organisms. As I'm sure you know, the older medicaments that we were using are non-specific in their action. They destroy protoplasm, and therefore they destroy the protoplasm of the microorganisms, and also when in contact with living human protoplasm, they destroy it as well. They're non-specific in their effect. We were looking for a kindlier chemical agent or agents which would destroy the microorganisms without, in a sense, destroying living tissue. I think that I was one of the first who, at least in dental literature, who used the eye of a rabbit to determine the irritating potential. And that goes back to a paper in the Dental, one of the four papers that were published in the Dental Cosmos 1931. At a later time, I used the shaved arm of volunteer students to determine the irritating potential of the four medicaments that we were using at that time. This was a blind study in that the students did not know which medicament was being used. And we determined the degree of irritation. As a matter of fact, there were five medicaments. The fifth one was formicresol, which we were not using at our school. And we found that they had varying degrees of irritating potential. The antibiotics, as a rule, are less irritating than these non-specific agents or non-specific chemicals. And so they were used on a rabbit by injection, by local application, by instillation in the eye. And we always had a feeling that if the Michigan group had thought of this first, they would have been very proud. But since they didn't, they kind of downgraded the use of the polyantibiotic. In something like 15 years, during which the polyantibiotic was used by the dental profession to a very great degree, as determined by the sales, there were only four or five cases of allergy reported. The incidence of allergy is less than that from aspirin. But the dental profession was afraid of sensitization. The result was that, and after a time, the dental manufacturer was not putting it out because there was less and less of a demand for it. As far as sensitization is concerned, I pointed out that we're all sensitized to antibiotics. At least those who drink milk are sensitized to penicillin. Those who eat fish and chicken are sensitized to the tetracyclines, which are fed to both fish and not fed to fish, but fed to chicken. And fish are preserved by spraying them with the tetracycline, et cetera, et cetera. That's neither here nor there. Although we had our differences, I want you to know that Ralph and I were close friends, and I really mean close friends. That I was at his home for dinner, I would say at least four or five times, and he and his wife were at our home for dinner at least the same number of times. And I lost a real friend when Ralph died. Ralph did not engage, or shall I say the Michigan group did not engage in research as much as the Philadelphia group did. They did have a good combination with Mary Crowley, who was a first-rate bacteriologist, and Darrell Ostrander. Ostrander had been a pharmacist, so that he had a good pharmacologic background. In our case, we had some good men, such as Bender and Seltzer, Snyder, and I'm sure there are more that I can't think of at the moment.
Did you know Mary Crowley well
at all? I sure did.
Could you give me some insight into her, how she got involved in the endodontic group?
Well, I'm not sure that I can give you the beginnings of it, but she taught microbiology at the dental school. And she had some good training under someone whose name I can't recall, but who was an outstanding microbiologist. She went overboard at times in regard to aseptic technique. However, you could not help but admire her for her knowledge of endodontics and her insistence on a thorough aseptic technique, which I'm afraid the average dentist could not follow. I think an endodontist can, but the average dentist could not follow. This is, again, where we differed. I felt that to get the general dentist to carry out root canal treatment, it's got to be a simple procedure. The result was that I tried to make it as simple as possible from a standpoint of equipment, using the Flaherty molten metal sterilizer, replacing that with glass beads, and ultimately replacing glass beads with salt. And the reason I replaced the glass beads with salt is that we had some accidents in which a small glass bead was lost in a root canal and couldn't remove it. No matter what we did, we had to do a root resection in more than one case. So it was a very simple procedure. Also, I pointed out to those who used the Mischinger technique that once you use an instrument in a root canal, you cannot use that instrument again according to their technique unless you autoclave it. But they did not autoclave it. They put the instrument in trichlor solution, which is an antiseptic cold sterilization method. And, of course, the instrument is not there long enough. My philosophy was that every instrument, before it is introduced into the root canal, must be freshly sterilized. So, by experiment with Dr. Appleton and myself, found that dipping the instrument, a long-handled instrument, such as an excavator, explorer, or whatever, dipping the working blade in alcohol, flaming it, and repeating this procedure a second time, flaming it, in 90-odd percent of cases, you had a sterile instrument. Likewise, using the glass bead or hot salt sterilizer, in 5 seconds, pre-cleaning an instrument as you should. You wouldn't think of putting an instrument that's just been used in the mouth in the autoclave. You scrub it first. Well, so too using a pre-cleaned instrument, such as a reamer or file, by simply running it through a cotton roll to remove the debris on it and placing it in the sterilizer for 5 seconds, you came out with a sterile instrument. Absorbent points require 10 seconds because they're porous. So that each instrument, according to our technique, was pre-sterilized just before it entered the pulp chamber or root canal.
Getting back towards culturing, what are your feelings now about culturing, which is basically a remnant of the focal infection theory, and the fact that not only is it been kind of discarded in a lot of programs as a routine thing, or at least put to the background rather than the forefront, and also the fact that now there have been studies that have come out that show that basically you may render a canal sterile of aerobic bacteria, but the only way of getting the anaerobes is to do a fairly complicated carbon dioxide type of incubation.
Yeah. In my days, at our school and at the Michigan school, students were required to have two successive negative cultures before they were allowed to fill a root canal. However, when we gave a course to dentists, we felt that one was sufficient. And the reason is that a student in clinic had had very little clinical bacteriological experience, whereas a dentist had. So that, and in my practice, I used only one negative culture before filling a root canal, and still do. I realize that not all diplomates today take cultures, which I think is a mistake.